it's whatever date and time you're listening, so that can only mean one thing. It's time for Magic by Design. If you're an old friend of the show or listening for the first time, thanks so much for stopping by. We are delighted to have you with us. Magic by Design is a Disney review podcast fated to watch and review every Disney animated film released in cinemas.
Even Fantasia.
Garrett.
All right. You haven't been introduced yet. All right.
In each episode, we watch a classic Disney movie, then we talk about it, and there's even a little song at the end. Mostly, not this week, so you don't even have that to look forward to. This week, we experienced Disney's 38th animated feature, Fantasia 2000.
Here we go again on our own.
But before the conductor strikes up the orchestra, allow me to introduce myself. I'm Ken, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host slash brother. You heard him just a moment ago, Garrett. Garrett, how are you?
Do we have to?
We do.
Do we have to?
We do, Garrett, because we've committed to doing all of them, and there would be a gap if we didn't.
But do we really have to?
I mean,
having horrible flashbacks to these package film eras where it's just like riddly diddly dee as some character is nonchalantly moving, not really to the music, but kind of to the music. Broadly to the music. We'll get into that. That's the problem with these films. And it's terrible and I don't like it. And I actually think this is worse than the original Fantasia, which at least has segments that I liked.
Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
Like, nothing in this Fantasia is as good as the Night in the Bald Mountain segment of the last Fantasia. Which is, like, actually, I think, the high point of Disney's music to animation format. And I don't even remember the films we mentioned it in, but, like, multiple times in the films since the package films and since Fantasia have we mentioned that Disney has done musical sections that are basically Fantasia better than Fantasia. Like, it's animation set to music in a way that's better and more satisfying than the actual films on which the entire premise of is animation set to music. So, just get out of here with your Fantasia. It sucks. Stop trying to make this happen, Disney. I'm excited for them in like 2020 or 2045 to be like, Fantasia 3!
Stop trying to make Fantasia a thing.
They really did. It's like at the start they were like, and we had this revolutionary idea that this would be an evolving concert where your favorite pieces would move in and out and new pieces would come, but it didn't happen. Until now. And then it's like, didn't happen then either, Disney. Stop trying to make Fantasia work.
I've been aware of this film for a long time, but it has never really occurred to me to watch it, especially after watching the original. As you may recall, dear listeners, we are not a fan, and by the start of this podcast, that reinforces that fact.
No, well, if you go back and listen to our Fantasia podcast, I think the thing we came down on was there were some really bad segments in Fantasia that were really boring, and then there were a few of them that worked and that were actually quite good. But the problem was, like, you know,
it's not enough to sustain a feature.
Yeah, and 60% of the film was bad and 40% of the film was good. But, like, I don't mind the core premise, the core idea of setting animation to music in a way that is very satisfying. Because when that's done well, it's really satisfying. I think it's done well twice in this movie, both for very short sections in the intro, which is like that abstract segment where like lightning is flashing and, you know, I think the animation is quite well set to the music there. And then the flamenco segment is 2 minutes long because they set the whole thing to animation. So when the flamingos jump, the music goes woo, and when they go down, the music goes down. And that's the way this is meant to work. And like, to be fair, that's really hard. That's really hard to sustain for long periods of time, to do like an 8 minute piece where everything that you're animating matches the music. So what happens is when they do 8 minute pieces where everything is supposed to match the music is everything just broadly matches the music. You know, it matches like the broader tone and spirit of the music without actually matching the beat to beat moment of the music. And if it doesn't match the beat to beat moment of the music, it just doesn't work. It's just boring otherwise.
I found myself in most segments and for long periods of other segments not even noticing the music. I was watching the visuals, which were varying in terms of quality. To your point, I don't think they've successfully pulled it off this time in all cases either. And it's a hard thing to do. Like, there's a reason that it works over 2 minutes rather than 8 minutes.
Yeah, it's really hard to do. And I don't deny this. That kind of animation, to do it that precisely for a long period of time and keep it interesting and keep it new and novel and fresh for like, what is it, six different segments, and freaking Sorcerer's Apprentice just dropped in here from the 1970s or 50s, 40s. When was Fantasia?
1940.
Yeah. 40.
You got it.
I got there in the end. Yeah, just dropping old segments in there. Like, it's hard to do. It's hard to execute for that long a period of time. But, like, watching The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which is quite boring to watch it again, but yeah. It's still better than everything in this film.
It really didn't have the same impact as the first time, maybe because we knew what to expect.
Yeah, and, like, maybe I will be bum 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 bum-ing all the way through this podcast like I was through the first Fantasia, but it hasn't been stuck in my head since. And, like, none of the music in this film has landed with me. Like, we watched this film the night before last, so we've had a full, like, 24-hour period where the music from this film could be pulsating its way through your brain constantly, and it's not even the bump da bump da bump da bubba bums.
Cheap plug before we proceed, go all the way back and listen to episode 3 to hear our thoughts on the original Fantasia.
3?
Yeah.
That was 3?
That was the third Disney film.
Really?
Yeah.
God. So they're like, we have done Snow White, we have done whatever the second one was.
Pinocchio,
yes. We are at the peak of our powers. We shall do
Fantasia. Let's ruin it.
And again, we have done Beauty and the Beast. We have done The Little Mermaid. We have done The Lion King. We are at the peak of our powers. Break the Fantasia glass.
There's some interesting points on the background, and you referenced some of them there, Garrett, but I just want to go through some of my initial thoughts first. This film is 15 minutes shorter than the original.
That's good.
That's 75 minutes versus 90 minutes. And I have to say, this version did feel much pithier. It just zooms by at a pleasing pace. So it does have that going for it.
I prefer the original.
Fair play. It's very experimental in certain sequences, much like the first film, to varying degrees of success, as we've noted.
You see, that is my problem with this film. I think I don't like any of the segments in this film.
Ooh.
None of them.
I disagree so much.
But I think the animation in some of them... Actually, no, I like the Donald Duck one, because I like Donald Duck. So
you're a sucker for Donald.
Yeah, you slap Donald in the film, and like, yeah, Donald's there. But and it's set to Macho Man Randy Savage's theme song. So it's Donald Duck running around doing antics, the Macho Man's theme. How can you not like that?
And the thing is, even if Donald spoke in that segment, you wouldn't understand him anyway, so nothing is lost.
Yeah, so I'm pro-Donald. But like, I just don't think this film works. I don't think these segments work. I don't think the music to it, animation bits work.
This film also needs to come with an epilepsy warning.
There is some like real... I'm surprised it probably does have it. If you look at the Disney Plus notes, I'd be surprised if it doesn't, because there is some like real, especially that opening sequence with the thunder like flashing all over the place.
Yeah, like even for people without epilepsy or disabilities, they struggle, because I found it very jarring at times.
Yeah, and like especially if you're watching on the big TV, we're watching on a relative... Actually, no, this is a 4K monitor, so it probably looks nice. I'm going to check, does it have an epilepsy? It doesn't have an epilepsy warning. It should.
It really should. They had a gimmick in this one, Garb, rolling out celebrities to introduce each segment. We'll talk about that as we go through them.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it added anything really to it.
I liked Steve Martin. Yeah, I thought he was funny.
He did a bit, at least.
And like I was like, oh, Steve Martin is going to be the host of this. I'm on board with that, but no, he was just the intro host, and I was like, oh well.
They were filmed separately in front of a green screen so they could slot them into the overall performance. A big note here, Gary, the 3D in this film is very bad overall.
Oh, it's terrible. Oh, the whales. Like, legitimately, this film started on a very sour note for me, because after the intro, then, you know, the flashing thunder and stuff, that's all
nice. That abstract stuff, it's pretty fine. Cool.
They go to this 3D section with just awful-looking whales. They look terrible. And it takes you out of it the entire time, because not only do they look terrible in a way that's, like, uncomfortable to look at and a little gross. And it's just like, this looks bad. Even this was nice, which it kind of wasn't. Like, those whales are so bad. And we've had good implementation of 3D in recent films. We watched Tarzan and we're like, oh, the way they've added depth of field here is actually quite cool. And we look at Mulan and, like, the way they did the Huns, oh, coming over the mountain and charging at everybody in large numbers looked quite cool. And now here we are with just some horrible, terrible, like, aged far before its time PS1 cutscene level CGI that they're dumping in this crappy Fantasia film. I didn't like it at all.
There are reasons for that, Gareth, so I'll give you some fun facts about why that was crap in a short while.
Did they try?
They did try. Finally, Gar, this film is part of a phenomenon around that time of everything released in 2000 having 2000 there.
Oh yeah, my first note. Adding 2000 to everything, question mark? Yeah. That's the first thing I wrote down. Like, I do love that.
It's just like that millennium thing of making everything sound futuristic by going like...
2000!
Bambi, 2000.
Now the mom's a robot. The deers are made mechanical.
Yeah, I just thought that was a funny note.
Yeah, like everything in the year 2000 was 2000. It's like, yeah, we're moving into the future here, folks. Y2K didn't take us down. Isn't Y2K like the biggest, like, because like Y2K was not a myth. It was an actual problem. They just solved it. And I think it's created this idea that like big issues are actually not big issues. They just go away. And instead, like big issues are big issues that smart people solve. Which was actually the case. It's like, this might be a real problem. We have to deal with it. We dealt with it. And then everybody assumed it wasn't actually real.
I also think it's interesting how that was a real problem. But now we've evolved with the help of internet and social media to fret about things that aren't even real.
Yes.
Like, you know, death cults that eat children to stay young.
Well, yeah, the George Soros and his army of liberal media who...
Wayfair.com.
Kidnapped children to suck their blood... No, these people.
Let's keep it fun. Garth.
They banned them from Twitter. We don't have to talk about them.
Yeah. We're free now.
Yeah.
We're free. As we know, Garth, Fantasia was released in 1940. And to your point, it was initially planned to have the film on continual release with new segments replacing older ones so that the audience would never see the same film twice. The idea was dropped when Fantasia flopped at the box office and received mixed critical response from critics. In fairness, before we jump on this, I actually liked that idea as a concept.
Yes.
Like a film that's forever growing and adapting and evolving. So it has some DNA with the previous version, but it's new every time you see it. That's a cool idea.
I wonder, like we watched this film in a bedroom watching on a computer monitor, which I feel like is not the way to watch this film.
Yeah.
I don't think any home theater version of this film is really the way to watch this film. Like, I do wonder how this film would work in a theater with an actual big screen experience and like good surround sound speakers, and like at least some of the awe and spectacle comes across. And then if you go a step further, I think the best way to see Fantasia would be as a live concert performance.
For sure.
Like, that feels like what this should be.
Like, Fantasia should be a franchise. Like, you know, like, they have their musicals wing, they have their theme parks. It should be, like, a thing in itself that's kind of a movie, but...
It's a touring show. It should just be a touring show.
It should be, like, Riverdance, but for animation.
Yeah, because we went to see Jurassic Park set to an orchestra playing the score. That's what this should be. So, like, watching it on demand on Disney Plus in a bedroom, not ideal. I don't even think... Like, as I said, I haven't seen it in a theatrical setting, so I can't judge it in a theatrical setting, but I feel like it would be better that way, but still not ideal. Like, this is just a touring show. Like, and that's what it can be. Like, they have a set list, and every night they do 80% of it, and 20% of it rotates. There you go. There's Fantasia. I fixed it for you, Disney.
And they have a whole department that just develops new segments for it.
Yeah, and then you take it on the road, and you have, like, two different crews traveling, doing Fantasia. And great!
Like Cirque du Soleil, like...
Or just make it a freaking theme park show. Is it a theme park show? It feels like it should be a theme park show.
Like, you have these things that tour again and again, but they, like... I've been to several Cirque du Soleil shows, and I've been told that they keep the name for brand recognition.
Yeah.
But they actually change up the elements inside of it.
Because they always have, like, subtitles. It's like Cirque du Soleil, blur.
OVO, or... I've seen a couple of them now. I can't remember the names.
And they're all different. They're, like, completely different performances, depending on which ones you see.
But even the individual performances will adapt over time. Like, people will leave, so they'll change the segments and stuff like that. That's what Fantasia should be.
Yeah, so even if you're not going to take it on the road as, like, this touring orchestra, do it in the theme parks. Why don't they do it in the theme parks?
You could have, like, a... Imagine that being your job. It's like, I'm a session violinist and I work at Disney World.
Yeah, Disney.
I just wear my tails and just sit there all day pumping out this 15-minute show.
Yeah, every 15 minutes we do a random set of Fantasia songs. And like, legitimately, I think that would be a good theme park attraction. It probably would be a little soulless to perform in, but I don't think there's anything soulful about theme parks in general, so that can't be helped.
Paycheck is a paycheck, Garth.
I say as someone who likes theme parks, by the way.
I love theme parks.
But they're literally walking brand messages.
I don't care if it is. It just makes me feel
happy. Do I? It's just like, people get so cynical about that. It's like, you're walking into Disney. This is all they're doing is selling you things. It's like, I don't care. I want to be. Look at the castle.
I'll eat that expensive food because it makes me feel good.
Yeah, curry popcorn. Yes. Yeah. Mickey Mouse shaped waffles. Of
Side
course.
Note, Tokyo Disney has the best theme park food.
Yes. Curry popcorn is delicious.
It had pancakes. They had Mickey waffles.
They had large chicken legs.
I think they were ham hocks.
Or turkey legs.
They had all that stuff.
Yeah.
The idea of a Fantasia sequel was revived shortly after Michael Eisner became CEO of the Walt Disney Company.
Bring back Katzenberg. Katzenberg would never. He would have never inflicted this on us.
Actually, this was in 1984.
Damn it.
But it was at the suggestion of Walt's nephew, Roy E. Disney. Eisner was intrigued by the idea, but believed that the studio didn't have the resources at the time, and Walt Disney Studios chairman, Jeffrey Katzenberg, was not keen on producing the film.
Oh, yeah, so yeah, bring back Katzenberg. The second, like, Katzenberg is out the door, it's like Fantasia time. It's like, we have to get Katzenberg out so he can do Fantasia.
Well, in fairness, it was greenlit on his watch car in 1991 after a 1990 re-release of the original film grossed $25 million at the box office, and its 1991 home video release received over 9 million pre-orders. Disney saw this as a sign of renewed interest in a sequel. Eisner approved on the basis that the video sales would fund the production. Production began under the working title of Fantasia Continued with the release in 1997. So that's like 6 years.
And then it took another 3 years to make, yeah.
The title was changed to Fantasia 1999, followed by 2000 to coincide with its actual theatrical release date. In 2000, it premiered in 1999.
Well, it premiered as a stage show in 99. It did have like a premiere, didn't it? Carnegie Hall? Was it Carnegie Hall?
Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, then it was released in IMAX, which I didn't know IMAX was a thing as early as 2000. But sure, yeah, it was, apparently. And then
that would have been a place to see this, to your point earlier.
Yeah, IMAX would have been a better... Like in the way they released it, Carnegie Hall, ideal setting for this. IMAX, second best.
Theatres.
And at home, no.
No, it's not meant to be watched at home. Disney formed its initial running order with half of the Fantasia program and only 3 or 4 new numbers, so they were going to keep a good portion of the original film.
What, so they're just going to slap out the original film and be like, there you go, job done? Why did this thing take like 7 years to make then?
The aim was to release a semi-new movie. Realizing that the idea would not work, they kept 3 Fantasia segments, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, The Nutcracker Suite, and The Dance of the Hours. They also wanted to keep the night at Bald Mountain, but it really didn't fit in anywhere.
It's the best one, though. Why did they not keep the best one?
So they went from keeping 4 of them to keeping 1.
And even 1, I think, was 1 too many.
Yeah. So eventually, as we said, The Sorcerer's Apprentice was the last man standing.
Totally.
It was kept as a homage to the original, so they wanted to have that link between the two.
And again, I think about the experiences of watching these as a podcast, doing them week to week, which means, like, we watched Fantasia sometime in April, May. It's now the start of January. So, like, that's been 7 months. That's a bit of a gap. But, like, Fantasia came out in 1940. Fantasia 2000 came out in 2000.
60 years
later. So it's 60 years since The Sorcerer's Apprentice has been on the screen. So maybe people... And, like, the people that went to see it as children in the 40s are, at the very earliest, in their 60s. So, you know... You could, I guess, thinking about it in that context, it's not actually that egregious to put that segment back in the film, because, like, and this isn't the era of like YouTube where you can just type The Sorcerer's Apprentice in and you can get The Sorcerer's Apprentice whenever the hell you want and watch it over and over again and watch it 7 times. You know, when that hasn't been in theater since 1940, it's been gone. Fair enough, there's probably like been VHS tapes, but you know, it's not this wide commercial thing you can easily watch. So I take it back that they probably shouldn't. I'm now fine with them including the complete Sorcerer's Apprentice segment in the film without being remastered in any really noticeable way.
Okay.
I'm fine with it.
Garrett, just
I've talked myself into
you
it.
You went on a whole journey there.
Yeah, I've talked myself into it.
Fantasia 2000 premiered in December 1999 at Carnegie Hall in New York City as part of a concert tour that also visited London, Paris, Tokyo, and Pasadena, California.
Pasadena, that's the, you know, you go to New York.
The cultural capital of the world.
You go to London, you go to Paris, you go to Tokyo, and then Pasadena.
The film was then released in 75 IMAX theaters worldwide from January 1st to April 30th, 2000. So it was like a limited engagement type thing.
Yeah.
Marking the first feature-length animation film to be released in the format.
So IMAX would have been new then, I would imagine.
Yeah, pretty new at the time, but it also just kind of... idea of a film being in the cinema for 4 months was quite novel as well, even though films that do really well these days, like Avatar, stayed in there a really long time.
But like back in the, like, it's not that novel, because like back in the 30s, a film would be in the theaters for months. Like
Star Wars stayed in there for the bones of a year, apparently.
Yeah, because like people marvel at the Gone with the Wind like box office number, and it is very big, especially adjusted for inflation. But like Gone with the Wind was in theaters for like 2 years.
I retract my statement, Gary. You've raised some very prescient points.
Yes.
Fantasia 2000 received mostly positive reviews from critics who praised the film overall while criticizing its uneven quality. Budgeted at around 80 to 85 million, the film grossed 91 million worldwide.
Ooh, that's a flop.
So it's likely that it lost money, but the concert tour may have made the venture profitable overall.
Unless the concert tour was also a flop.
I couldn't find any info on that.
So yeah, maybe the concert, because they don't still, like, obviously we say the best place to see this is as a concert.
They haven't done it since.
The reason they probably haven't done it is it didn't do well. And if it did well, they'd do it. And the reason they don't do it is because it didn't do well. Stop trying to make Fantasia happen.
Okay, let's get into it, Kara. The opening sequence is an abstract, similar to the original movie, set to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. More variety than the original opening segment, but visually attacks the eyes at times, as we said.
Yeah, it's a little overwhelming. Takes your, there really is, like, just flashing everywhere, and there's some, like, real stuff. As I said, if you do have epilepsy, you will have to look away from this film for a while. And I'm honestly surprised that they don't have that warning there.
This one is introduced by surviving archival recordings by original Fantasia host Deems Taylor.
Mm-hmm. It's Deems, again, going back to his name.
Yes.
Deems.
Yeah. What kind of name is that?
Yeah. We're just doing bits we did like 7 months ago. This is the Fantasia 2000 equivalent of our podcast, where we're just like, Deems, that's a funny name.
Yeah, we're going to like put in new bits, but mostly it's the old podcast.
We should actually do that as a bit. We should just run like what we said about the Sorcerer's Apprentice from from Fantasia.
And then I present it as if it's new, just not even say anything. Created by Pixote Hunt with story by Kelvin Yasuda. The segment combines hand-drawn backgrounds using pastels and paint that were scanned into computer animation software CAPS, which was developed by Pixar, as we spoke about in previous weeks, and computer-generated imagery CGI of abstract shapes and effects were layered on top. So it's a mixture of the two worlds.
Yeah, it looks like, I think this one looked pretty good. Not nearly as bad as the whales.
Hunt explained that scanning each drawing was a one-shot deal, as the plating that pressed onto it would alter the pastel once it had been scanned, so you couldn't scan a drawing more than once, or they have to get it right.
Is that what happened with the whales?
At one point in production, Hunt and Yasuda completed 68 pastel drawings in 8 days. Yeah, I think it shares a lot of DNA with the opening segment of the original one, in that it's meant to be abstract and kind of reacting to the sound waves and stuff like that. You have those kind of triangles that form butterflies as well. It's pretty to look at, and it doesn't outstay its welcome.
Yeah, and as I said, along with the flamingo segment, it is the only one that I think actually has music matching animation in a way that's actually kind of interesting.
It's kind of funny how it's like the first one, it's like, okay, yeah, lots of effort matching the music, and it just kind of wanes. Yeah. And then in the middle, it goes back up, and it's like they only really made an effort with a few of them. Garrett, moving on here to The Pines of Rome by Ottorino Respighi, introduced by Steve Martin and Itzhak Perlman.
Again, I was very excited that the prospect of Steve Martin hosting this entire thing, and then there were other people. I guess there were good other people, but still.
This is interesting. The director is listed as Butoy, B-U-T-O-Y.
Uh-huh.
Don't know who that is. With James Fuji handling the story.
I like the way Ken's like, I don't know, it's like, research? Nah.
3D whales in the sequence have aged really badly, as we said. They looked like slugs.
Yeah.
The eyes stick out in a really bad way. They look really stuck on.
They look like Dark Souls. Oh, they look like Dark Souls enemies, I was going to say. But the eyes look like clip art. For like Microsoft clip art from like 2000 slapped onto these 3D whales in a way that's not very nice at all.
And the movement of the whales is really labored and unnatural as well. I know they're floating.
Have you ever seen whales fly?
No.
Maybe that's how they fly.
Overall, I got a feeling of being cheap and unfinished. Butoy created a musical intensity chart for animators to follow, which tracked the ups and downs of the music. As the music brightens, so does the color, and vice versa. That was not successful, by all accounts.
Like, one of my major notes was, whale section just does not particularly suit the music. Like, that's one of my major notes.
I found myself, like, horroring at the visuals and then not even paying attention to the music.
Yeah, because, like, what they do, they do the, as I said, they do the music too broadly. It does match the major emotions of the piece, but that's about it. So really what you're watching is like, it's not really like what this movie should be is more of a rhythm movie. So if you ever play a rhythm video game, it's like where we press the button in line with the beat and something happens. That's what should be happening here. It should be a rhythm movie. What they end up doing is basically just, they do a series of wordless shorts that, you know, like they score it as if they would score Tarzan, you know, this is the exact same way they score Tarzan, which is the reason this doesn't feel special. So like when the action ramps up in Tarzan, the music ramps up, because that's the way film scoring works. So it just ends up just being something really basic, like that you see in every single film, instead of something like really special and interesting.
Yeah, because when it's timed to the music like that, you should feel it viscerally rather than just with your ear. It should be an overall experience that kind of consumes your whole body, where, as you said, this is more of a standard film score. But Toei explained that because CGI was in its infancy during development, the first third of the segment was hand-drawn using pencil to get a feel for how the whales would move. When the drawings were scanned into the CAPS system, Buttoy found the whales were either moving too fast or had less weight to them. The drawings were altered to make the whales slow down and more believable. Still not successful.
Though the people, it's like when CGI was in its infancy. Like, this is the year 2000.
We've had two Pixar films at this point, Gar.
Isn't it three? Isn't Toy Story 2 out by now?
No, not until 2001.
So yeah, we have A Bug's Life and we have Toy Story, both of which look great. And as I said, we have, like, good 3D implementation in these films going back to The Rescuers, so... Or not even The Rescuers, further back to the one before that with the mice. Great Mouse Detective, which actually had good, like, 3D implementation. Remember the clock tower?
Yeah.
It looks much better than these whales.
This explains a lot, Gar. The eyes of the whales were drawn by hand, as the desired look could not be achieved in 3D by the animators. Remember, so what we're saying is that it wasn't in its infancy. They didn't know how to use it.
Remember the clip art mascot for Microsoft Word? Clippy? Clippy? Was that his name? Did he have a name?
Yeah, let's go.
What's he up to? Is he dead? Did Microsoft just kill the clip art thing? I'm going to Google what the name of the Microsoft clip art monstrosity is.
I'll keep going. But I also recall the challenge of having water appear to move as naturally as possible. The team decided to write computer code from scratch, as traditional animation wouldn't have been too time-consuming and would have produced undesired results. Again, I didn't think the water looked particularly good in this segment.
No. There was a period where it actually looked quite realistic, and I was like, ooh.
And here's another thing. They used code to animate the pod of whales that was similar to the stampede in The Lion King. Mm-hmm. And again, that was from like 6 years previous, and it looked even better than this.
Yeah.
So like, they've used all these elements that they've used before, and they've perfected in other mediums and movies, but they used them like worse.
It's, yeah, which is the reason I thoroughly dismissed their CGI was in its infancy nonsense. Yeah. There's freaking PS1 video game models that look better than this game. Get out of here. Get out of town.
Like, the intro segment isn't very long and it sets the tone, right? So this is the first real segment of the movie. Like, and it really needs to be impactful and get you off to a great start. I really thought this fell flat.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on here, Gar, to the Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin, introduced by Quincy Jones, father of Rashida Jones, as Gar was surprised to find out.
Yeah, I did not know that.
This one is directed and animated by Eric Goldberg. Gershwin is the first American composer featured in a Fantasia film. I really liked the visual style of this one, which was inspired by the art of Al Hirschfeld. It had some really funny visual gags. It tells the story of a day in the life of New York City, told through the eyes of a few central characters. Basically, we see the plot of Soul at one point.
Yeah.
We won't go into that for spoilers. Sake. The action moves at the same pace as New York, so if you've ever been there, it literally doesn't stop. So like, if you stop,
I haven't been there.
I have been there.
No one can go there now unless you're already there.
I've been there like three times, and like, I remember the first time it was really overwhelming because there's so many people and they move so quickly, and like, you stop to try and look up and people just like zoom past you.
I remember our dad went to New York, and the first day he absolutely hated it for that reason, I think, because like, it's just so hustle bustle, everything was moving, you can't like stand still without being trampled and stampeded like the Lion King. And then by the end of it, like, that hustle bustle is like, that's the appeal of the city at the end of the day. And you're like, oh, it's the city that never sleeps, and you get it. But I found it quite amazing that he hated its guts. He hated that city. I thought the animation in this was very nice.
Yeah.
I thought the animation style was very nice, which it says something that they ripped off someone else's style. But
I like the
paid homage.
I like the colors as well. It's kind of like this kind of cool color palette.
I think this looks very pretty in terms of the narrative. Yeah. In terms of the music, even more, eh.
I thought this was one of the better ones. I really enjoyed that jazz-style music.
I think it looks nice.
I thought the music, I don't think it just really matched the visuals all the time, although there was points where it did sync up, but it is...
There's like a part where he's like drinking the coffee and the thing and the crowds are going back and forth. It's like, oh, look, they're trying. And then the rest of it is just like, ugh.
But it is really suited to the piece.
Like, I think it looks nice.
The music goes really well with it. I thought that the fast pace of the music and the visuals gave the short a sense of life and momentum that we don't see in the other ones.
Mm.
The music was recorded previously, one of two pieces in the film not performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
What was the other one?
The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Oh, I was hoping it would be something else, and I'd be like, the Sorcerer's Apprentice can. You'd be like, oh yeah, of course, damn.
The segment was completed 2 months ahead of schedule. Despite this, the sequence was so chromatically complex that the rendering process using the CAP system delayed work on Tarzan. because they were using the same software. So
what, is it like a computer in the office? They're like, only one of us can use the CAPS computer today. And the Tarzan team are like, our release date is sooner. Let us use the computer.
They were hovering around, like, and just getting into fights over the CAPS system.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can see what they mean, because the transition of color in this seems simple. But like, to get that visual harmony that they got in the piece, it's actually quite complicated to render those colors. So like, it looks like a 2D film and it looks like a 2D drawing because it's based on caricatures. But it's actually all done in 3D.
Wow. It does look nice. Especially like in the ending shot when it pans out to this like neon city flashing. It looks nice. As I said, I don't particularly like the substance of it. But on the surface, it looks very pretty.
This was my favorite one, I have to say.
Donald wasn't in it.
Next, we have Piano Concerto No. 2 by Dmitri Shostakovich. Introduced by Bette Midler and pianist Yefim Bronfman.
Nailed it.
This one tells the story of the Steadfast Tin Soldier, written by Bianca Margiole in 1938. More uncanny 3D here. This is the first Disney film of any kind to feature characters entirely rendered in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
But to that point, Gar, the Jack in the Box is the thing of nightmares.
Oh, yeah. I think it all looks just kind of more like the Uncanny Valley Tin Soldier.
Good one, Gary.
Got him.
Like, I know it's a short story. They need to kind of get from A to B very quickly, but there's some very convenient storytelling here.
Again, it's like, the narrative. How does he get back? Ugh.
At one point, a soldier falls out of the window with a boat, and he just lands in the boat. Like, that's very convenient. And also, what are the odds that the fish that ate the soldier would end up in the same house that he came from?
For a shock. And then he'd be not eaten. And then... I don't care. I'm trying to muster interest in this mediocre animated short, and I can't.
My overwhelming feeling here was that I didn't notice the music.
No, I couldn't. As I said, I couldn't even tell you what the music was, the majority of these.
Yeah, like the visuals I was watching, because it was somewhat novel as a first for the studio, and some of it was truly horrifying, including the rats as well, which I think looked more like traditional animation, but I'm not sure. Again, it just seemed traditionally scored, so it's not matching the music with the visuals.
Well, like it is, but as I said, on just a broad level, that doesn't feel like what this thing should be going for, and thus makes it actually quite boring.
A fun note, Care, for you. The rain animation at the start was from Bambi, 1942, which was scanned into the CAPS system and digitally altered to fit the segment. And the ending was to feature the original ending in the story with the soldier and the ballerina melting in the fire. But the music was considered too upbeat to animate to it, and it was changed.
Yeah.
So, like, in the original story, it's actually quite sad because they escape the clown or whatever it is. I don't know if it's
evil jack-in-the-box clown,
whatever it is, and they end up in the fire, so like they are together but they die.
Oh, they should see bold storytelling choices. I would have admired it. That's the like, none of these things are interesting. There's just like nothing interesting about any of these animated pieces. That's the problem. There's plenty of Pixar shorts that don't have a dialogue. You know, go and watch them. There's plenty of them that are entirely wordless, and they're really artful and interesting, and some are moving and some are really funny. And none of these are any of that. It's just nothing. There's nothing going on. I hate this movie.
I think it's classic how that's like 1940s storytelling always had to have like cautionary tales for children. It's just like, yes, you will end up with your love, but you will die because you have been disobedient. Moving on here, got to one of your faves, the Carnival of the Animals finale by Camille Saint-Saëns. Saint-Saëns?
Nailed it. Is it French? You should know it if it's French.
Introduced by James Earl Jones and animator Eric Goldberg. Eric Goldberg was assisted by his wife Susan, who was the art director. Like, it tells the story, like, basically, he was fascinated by one of his colleagues. I think it was during the production of Pocahontas, would play with a yo-yo.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he got the idea from. So
it was like, flamingos will play with yo-yos.
It's like, where did the flamingo get the yo-yo from, though?
But who knows?
They should have shown that. Like, it fell out of a tour bus or something. I don't know.
That tour bus?
Yeah.
Why would it fall out of a tour bus?
This one is very short and sweet, so it's over before you settle into it. Like, as you said, it's timed to the music, so like blink and you'll miss it.
Yeah.
Like, I almost can't remember what happened because it was so quick.
Yeah, because he has a yo-yo and he's swinging the yo-yo, and when he swings the yo-yo, everyone jumps and the music goes, woo! And like, as I said, like, this is the thing that the entire film should be. But making the entire film like this is really hard. But they decided to do it. I'm not the one that commissioned this whole idea. So just that it's really hard, that's not an out. Don't make the film if it's too hard for you to do it. Flamingo, and I liked it.
The segment was produced with CGI and 6,000 watercolor paintings on heavy bond paper. I didn't notice that this was CGI.
No, I would say like, yeah, that I didn't think about it at the time either way, but like, yeah, it's not hand drawn, you can tell.
Yeah, you can tell it's too smooth and graphical, but at the same time, they do a nice job of shading it to make it look like traditional animation.
Mm.
Animators chose a distinct color palette for the segment, which was compared to the style of a Hawaiian shirt, which Eric Goldberg famously wears every day. The Goldbergs and their team visited the zoo in Los Angeles and San Diego to study the anatomy and movement of flamingos.
Are they the
classic Disney trip, Kerr?
Are they the Goldbergs upon which the television show The Goldbergs is based?
No relation.
Oh.
There's a lot of Goldbergs in America, Kerr.
I've been watching The Goldbergs as like background noise. It's like, that's a nice show.
Yeah, I used to watch it when I had my own house. I don't have one anymore. But it is a pleasant show. Like, you can kind of watch it and not watch it. But if you do watch it, it's got some good laughs. It's got the nostalgia in there.
Because I remember when it premiered, I would have watched, because like it was one of the shows that year. That I'm like, oh, The Goldbergs, that seems interesting. I'll give it a go. And I probably watched like 5 or 6 episodes. I'm like, yeah. But it's like, it's on TV. I throw it on as background noise while I'm working. And it's like, get a couple of chuckles out of it. It's like, good job, The Goldbergs.
I remember that.
And the good job, these other Goldbergs, who made one of the few animated sequences in this film that actually matches the music. Well done.
Yes.
Goldberg's doing well all around. Bill Goldberg, Royal Rumble. Look at all these successful Goldbergs. All successful at once in my life.
Yeah, it's like, what do they call that? That's when you see Goldberg and then you see it everywhere.
Yeah, it's
that Bader Meinhof complex.
Yeah. Or like when you're driving a car in Grand Theft Auto. Or actually, it happened in Cyberpunk as well, where like all the NPCs in Cyberpunk are the same. So like it loads in one NPC and there's like 100 clones on the same street. So it's that, but in real life.
Next up is The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Paul Dukas, introduced by Penn and Teller. This segment appears exactly as it did in the original, and the music was the same piece conducted by Leopold Stokowski in 1938. It feels to me like they might have punched up the sound and cleaned up the visuals a bit, but nothing huge, as you said earlier.
Should have done a sequel.
Yeah.
Should have made a new one. No, I decided it's fine. Sorry.
Yeah.
I won't say they should have done a new one. I've decided it's fine to put it back in the film. It's been 60 years.
As you said, go back to episode 3 if you want to hear what we think about that segment.
It was introduced by Penn and Teller as well, by the way.
I said that when you interrupted me, Gar.
Did I? Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, Penn and Teller. Magic people.
That was a fun bit as well, them doing their shtick.
Once in an episode of The West Wing.
Yes, of course. Famously.
Yeah.
Second to last, we have Pomp and Circumstance by Edward Elgar, introduced by Fantasia 2000 composer James Levine, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. Michael Eisner suggested Pomp and Circumstance as a piece after he attended a graduation. He's like, I know classical music. He's like in the pitch meeting. He's like, I know classical music. And like,
oh, yes, Michael, what's your favorite? But the one they play at graduations.
And Macho Man Randy Savage comes out.
Oh, yeah, Macho Man. Donald. All right, challenge to go straight from a Macho Man Randy Savage impression to a Donald Duck.
I thought you were holding your own on the Macho Man. And
oh, well, Macho Man is the easiest impression to do of all impressions. He's the Macho Man. Ooh, yeah. Legitimately, like, everybody can do a Macho Man impression. It's actually harder not to do a Macho Man impression than do a Macho Man impression.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Dig it. You just have to be really gravelly and then speak in that like weird cadence that Macho Man speaks in.
It really ruins your voice.
So does it imagine doing a Donald Duck impression. It's just choking. It's just choking as you say words.
No, let's not ruin our podcast listeners' ears anymore. Eisner's original idea involved a selection of Disney princesses and heroes in a wedding procession carrying their future children who would be presented in a ceremony. Kind of like the Lion King, I suppose.
Mm.
The animator's preliminary designs depicted a Greco-Roman setting. One of the staff members described the artwork as an appalling abuse of the characters, leading to Eisner agreeing that the story be dropped, but insisted that the music be used. This seems like an executive goes into a pitch meeting and like he makes all these suggestions that are stupid and they try to humor him a bit and like they don't work, but like it's just typical like corporate interference.
Yeah. And then he's like, it doesn't work, do it again. And they're like, we didn't even want to do this in the first place. We've only done this stupid segment that we don't want for you. And then you come parachuting in telling us it doesn't work. No shit.
As you said earlier, they cart out Donald Duck here and Daisy to bring in the punters. It tells the story of Noah and the Ark with a twist. Very much the Disney House animation style at the time. Nothing new in terms of the visuals.
You called out the Lion King. It does look very Lion King.
Yeah, you commented on that at one point as well.
Even like the way that they're going toward the Ark legitimately just looks like they took a shot from the Lion King that had Pride Rock in it and just dropped an Ark on top. And there you go. We're done.
Yeah, it's
but it's nice. It's nice to have like Donald in one of these. This is the first time Donald's been in anything in decades.
Since the package movies, Gar.
Yeah, and the same with Mickey Mouse. At least to have a little bit of Mickey Mouse representation in the mainline animated films, because it's been a very long time since that's been the case.
Yeah,
and they haven't been since.
They've had like TV movies.
And, oh yeah, but those aren't real. We're talking about canon Disney animated features. Magic by Design covered films, Ken.
There's been a plan for a Mickey Mouse film for a long time, but it hasn't seen the light of day.
He's going to be out of copyright soon. They've got to get it while they can before we can make our own Mickey Mouse films.
Yeah, there's a weird kind of juxtaposition here, because most of the animals are animals, but then Donald and Daisy are anthropomorphic beings who wear clothes and assist in a what? They're the two ducks on the ark, but they are also human-like characters. So maybe I'm thinking about it too much.
My favorite part was when they finished all the flooding and they were coming out, and then you saw the crabs and you were like, how come the crabs survived? And I'm like, no shit.
But they had to have two of each of them, guys. Were there any crabs?
The crabs won't drown, Ken. All of the crabs are fine. There's no fish on the boat because fish survive in the water.
So did God intend for the sea creatures to inherit the earth?
Yes. The fish are fine.
Oh God's like, I'm trying to drown these things, but it's not working.
Where did this dude get the idea to frickin' build an ark?
There's also a funny gag where dragons and unicorns are there, but there's only one of each of them, so they all die in the flood.
Yeah.
That's kind of grim, but funny. But it's basically your common Donald scenario where it's a comedy of errors. Him and Daisy both think that the other is dead, and they keep missing each other on the ark. So it's quite fast-paced as well. There are parts here of pomp and circumstance that I've heard in other contexts, but I didn't know were part of this piece. So we all know the main piece that you see in.
Because like the Macho Man theme is like the very end. It's the crescendo. The do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Yeah, doing the twirling finger. Like that's the part we all know, and that's the part that play graduations as well. So like that's the bit everybody knows because it's the famous bit. Like there's this whole like 4 minutes building up to that. So
yeah,
it's actually quite a nice piece of music.
Nice piece of music. I don't think it matched the visuals that well.
But I think the way they built the crescendo to when Donald and Daisy finally got together, I thought was quite nice.
It's quite nice, but like...
In a traditionally scored way, I think it was the best of the traditionally scored things.
Yeah, but going back to our point earlier, it feels like it's shoehorned in there because they were told to do it and then they made something to match it rather than...
Donald is there, so it's the best.
The final segment this time is the Firebird 1919 version by Igor Stravinsky, introduced by Angela Lansbury, who does not sing anything from Beauty and the Beast.
Very upsetting.
Total missed opportunity. To close the film, Disney wanted a piece that was emotionally equivalent to the Night on Bald Mountain and Ave Maria segments that closed Fantasia.
They didn't nail it, but no. You can really feel them going for it. Like it's like, oh yeah, look at them trying to do the same thing as the last one.
This short gave me serious Moana vibes. It has a lot of DNA in common, like that lava monster.
Make way.
That sprite looks like Tafiti.
Moana, it's time you knew. Much better music. This one is clearly a metaphor for Donald Trump, Ken.
Yes.
That no matter how much good, Ken, no matter how much beauty, no matter how much decency there is in the world, one bad actor, just one thing, one volcano mountain can fuck it all up and ruin it all up and burn it all to the ground, ruining everything. But Ken, from a single hope, from a single seed of hope, everything can grow again. Joe Biden.
But I like that in that, like, the traditional narrative is that they would have saved the day at the last second. But no, this bad force has won.
He ruined everything.
And we have to rebuild. So that's a very good metaphor, as you said, Gary.
That stag was no use when everything was burning.
Was that stag God?
Maybe.
Because he had special breath powers that make things come to life.
And he blew on the spirit of life, whatever the spirit is.
It came back to life again.
Came back and then...
But can it be dead if it's not alive? Or not dead? Well,
I don't know.
The stag was really nicely animated. Weirdly, though, everything was animated in 2D, except the antlers, which were 3D. I don't know what the purpose of that was.
Because you got to see the depth of the antlers. Antlers can.
The sprite character was inspired by a dryad-like creature from Greek mythology. Her form changes multiple times, so she is water, she's earth, she's flowers, so she's basically...
Everything. Deus ex spirit character.
Now that I think about it, Mother Nature, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. I thought this segment, as you said, they were reaching for something big, a big crescendo, something with the same emotional pull as Night on Bald Mountain, but I don't think you can compare it to that segment. It's a really impactful segment in the original film, and actually I would have been in favour of them updating that one.
Yeah.
And keeping it in the movie.
They would have given Nicole something to sing.
It would have.
Is she singing anything?
No.
Oh.
Spoilers.
But she could have... There is a sung version of Prompt and Circumstances in here. There are lyrics to that. Someone goes, la, 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 la.
She couldn't find a track.
La, 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 la.
Well, you've given it to them now, Gar.
There you go.
La, la.
You keep going. I'll just sing under it.
La, 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 there isn't much to... La, In terms of the... It's very distracting.
Alright, keep going.
You may be surprised to hear, Gareth, there isn't much in terms of the legacy of this film. We do see evidence in this movie of Disney dipping their toe into the plane of 3D character animation, which would proceed in the following years.
Mm-hmm.
Development began on a third film in 2002 under the working title Fantasia 2006, but the project was abandoned in 2004 due to undisclosed reasons. The segments that
were... I realised it was shit.
Care. You've cursed three times in this podcast.
I know, I'm just giving you so much more work.
I can make the bleep you so many times.
I should just go on a run of cursing just to annoy you.
The segments that were already developed for the film were released as shorts instead.
The legacy of this film, Ken, it should be a cautionary tale. A cautionary tale they did not learn in the 1940s, but maybe had an excuse in the 1940s because, like, war. Then you're like, oh, Fantasia didn't work because war. They don't have that excuse anymore. Fantasia doesn't work. Stop trying. Stop doing Fantasia. No one wants it. It's not good. It doesn't work. Stop doing it. And if it comes in like 19 or in 2035 or whatever, Ken, and they're like, what if we do Fantasia again? I will picket the offices of Disney. I will show up with this podcast recording of me telling you right here on January 17th, 2021 at 5:08 in the afternoon that Fantasia does not work. Learn from the two times you tried and failed.
My overwhelming feeling echoes your sentiment, Gareth. I feel like, having watched both these movies and the entire package era, I can appreciate these pieces as a place for experimentation and testing different types of storytelling and experimentation with music as well. But I want these things as an extra before my feature, not as a feature in itself. That way, it feels like a treat, and if I don't totally dig it, it's a bonus. I am now firmly convinced that this format doesn't have what it takes to carry an entire 90-minute film.
Nah, it doesn't work as a feature. And we have plenty of evidence that these things don't work as features, and we have plenty of evidence that shorts do work, and I enjoy shorts. Plenty of Pixar shorts don't have words. What was that one about the volcanoes recently that didn't have words, didn't it?
Yeah,
that was very nice.
That also inspired Moana.
Yeah,
there you go.
So yeah, make good things, don't make bad things, and then put all the bad things together into one large bad thing.
Like,
isn't Aristocats bad? Oh
yeah, Aristocats and Black Cauldron.
Black Cauldron is mediocre.
But it has a right to exist, Karen.
Black Cauldron's better than this. Black Cauldron isn't upsettingly bad. This is...
Yeah, I had a certain sense of completion from Black Cauldron, but I always come away from these films, especially Fantasia 1 and 2, feeling a little hollow and unsatisfied. Separately, these shorts could have merit, but as a whole package, it just doesn't land, doesn't it?
No, I don't actually think there's particularly good shorts. There's a nice little Donald Duck one, and the city one looks nice. It's well animated. And for me, that's all this film has going for it. Like, all in the 1:15 runtime, I think one of them looks nice, and Donald Duck amuses me.
Yeah, so if you'd watched that as a prelude to a Disney feature, you'd be like, oh, that's a nice bonus.
Yeah,
I wasn't expecting that. Or even if you didn't like it, you were like, okay,
now on to the thing I came for.
Exactly.
Bum, bum, bum,
imagine
bum,
this bum, being bum, the bum, thing bum. You came for,
Jeremy. I know, it would be so upsetting. All I'd have is the bump, the bump, the bump, the bubba bumps.
All right, musical maestros, we've nearly come to the end of the show for another week. Sadly, there are no songs in Fantasia 2000, but fear not, resident musical expert Nicole is still waiting in the wings to deliver some interesting tidbits of trivia about the music of the film.
Yeah, we're clueless dopes who actually know nothing about music, so we're really like this. We're actually the total wrong audience for this thing.
Yeah.
But still.
We didn't even talk about the music that much, so Nicole will save us and inform you about all that. You can find brand new episodes of Magic by Design every Monday, where all magical podcasts are downloaded. Check out our website at magicbydesign.buzzsprout.com to find a full list of podcast providers. There, you'll also find all our previous episodes if you're catching up or feel like revisiting an old favorite. Magic by Design is also on all your favorite social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/magicbydesignpod, on Twitter at magicdesignpod, and on Insta at magicbydesignpod. If you're enjoying our Disney evaluations and want to support the show, please do consider giving us a review on your podcast platform of choice. Share the podcast on your socials, or even recommend the show to a fellow Disney fan. If you don't give us a 5-star review, we will make you watch both Fantasias back to back.
Forever.
Forever.
You can't escape those terrible looking whales, or that really long Big Bang dinosaur one. Remember that one? That one was terrible.
It's a poor man's Land Before Time.
But then you'll enjoy Night and Ball Mountain, because that's cool. And you'll see the Sorcerer's Apprentice more than you ever want.
We'll be back next week at the same time, same place, with a review of Disney's 39th animated feature, Dinosaur.
Oh, no.
But until then, stay safe.
I've never seen Dinosaur. I shouldn't. Oh, no, Ken. I shouldn't prejudge it as you're trying to get out. Ken's trying to just end the podcast. I'm like, no, we're going to talk about Dinosaur for a second.
No, we're not, Ken. We're going to talk about it next week.
I shouldn't be like, oh, no. That's me engaging with Dinosaur in bad faith, Ken. Maybe I'll love Dinosaur. I don't know.
Keep an open mind, Gar, until next week. But until then, stay safe and remember, life's a lot like jazz. It's best when you improvise. That's a little quote by Gershwin there, because there's no words in his film.
Should have just taken a line from Soul.
Now then, Nicole is here.
Made it like a Steve Martin joke.
God damn it.
You really can't finish the podcast.
We need to finish this podcast.
So I'm going to read Steve Martin's most recent joke tweet, and that's what we'll end on.
Now then, Nicole is here with a symphony of fun facts about the musical Fantasia 2000. Thanks for listening. Now over to you, Nicole.
Give me a joke, Steve Martin. No, you've let me down. Stop quote tweeting things. I just made up a cryptic crossword clue. They're descended from raptors. I don't get it.
Hello there, Disney fanatics. It's me, your musical correspondent, Nicole, coming to you live from my bedroom. This week, we're looking to the millennium for Fantasia 2000, a Disney sequel and an ode to classical music. The movie begins with Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, arguably the most famous symphony by the composer and in classical music in general. Who doesn't know that intro? The drama. Pines of Rome was rearranged in 1993 by Bruce Colin, who reduced the four-movement piece by cutting the second movement and trimming sections of the third and fourth movements. He may as well have done away with the whole thing, to be honest. Next was Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin, a favourite composer of mine, especially for his musical theatre songs. I particularly love this piece because of the clarinet. It's just so sexy at the start of this piece. Yes, you heard that right. Sexy. The recording of Rhapsody in Blue used in the film is an edited version of Ferd Grofe's orchestration of the piece, performed by the Philharmonia Orchestra with conductor Bruce Broughton. Russian composer Shostakovich is arguably the most celebrated composer of the 20th century. His Piano Concerto No. 2 was composed for his son Maxime for his 19th birthday. It's cheerful and fun, uncharacteristic of Shostakovich. There is still a few dark elements dotted in there if you listen out for them. The Carnival of the Animals by French composer Camille Saint-Saëns is all about fun. For me, this is my favourite animation of Fantasia 2000. It was composed after a terrible German concert tour. Saint-Saëns gave private performances of the piece but insisted it was not published until after his death to maintain his serious composer image. Very important. Next is The Sorcerer's Apprentice, using the original recording from 1938, featuring conductor Leopold Stokowski with a group of session musicians. A segment of Pomp and Circumstance by English composer Edward Elgar is used for the next piece, as a military march. This is one segment of one piece of six under Opus 39. The movie ends with a piece by Stravinsky called The Firebird Suite. You hear the darkness of his music from the beginning. It's dramatic, suspense-like, and exciting. And again, a favourite of mine. Apart from The Sorcerer's Apprentice and Rhapsody in Blue, all the other pieces were recorded by the Chicago Philharmonic Orchestra, with conductor James Levine. I adored this movie as a kid, as it introduced me to classical music, and a wide range of composers who could compose for instruments in varying ways, with different techniques, moods, styles, textures. It always astonishes me how an orchestra or group of instruments can be wielded to create such dynamic sounds, be it sinister or cheerful. That's it for this week, folks. No songs to be sung, but I'll be back next week.